Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Building Security in the Next Decade podcast. I'm Sammy Miguez.
And I'm Drew Kilborn.
Together, we have about 60 years of experience in the software and security spaces. This is where we talk with industry leaders about the cybersecurity challenges waiting for all of us just over the horizon. Today, it's our great pleasure to introduce our friend, Richard Jones. Rich has over 30 years of risk technology, business, and management experience supported by a record of initiating and leading core strategic initiatives. His career includes managing a variety of cybersecurity functions, such as implementing secure controls for mainframes, mid-range computers, applications, DNS, cloud, data, time services, Unix, Windows, endpoints, messaging, and third-party risk. He's managed risk globally for several financial institutions, including JP Morgan Chase, and is also doing so in his current role at TD Bank. His work spans cybersecurity, technology, IT risk, compliance, and enterprise application security. In addition, his accomplishments also include several U.S. patents. Rich, it's really great to have you with us here today.
Thanks for having me, Sammy.
Well, let's jump right in then. You know, you're an experienced cybersecurity professional. You've seen a lot of change over the years. You know, we all have our perspective of where cybersecurity is today, sort of the state of security. And let's just say with regard to applications, software security. So what are some of the events, some of the innovations, perhaps, that led us to the broad state of cybersecurity that we have today? How'd we get here?
Yeah, so, I mean, you've heard many times cybersecurity is a fairly new field. Even today, I keep hearing leaders within the cybersecurity space, you know, cite the fact that they're committed to making the same mistakes differently. What's interesting, Sammy, is, you know, it's one of the few fields, if you look or draw a comparison to things like the medical field, there's a prescribed way to remove an appendix or perform a surgery, yet even decades after cybersecurity is, as you know, what we'll call birth itself, there's still a lot of variation in terms of how different leaders approach cybersecurity. And I would say there's a couple of things driving that, right? The threats continue to change. So the Captain Crunch threat back in the 70s than some of the threats we're dealing with today. And so we have to evolve, we have to adapt, but it's the struggles are real. The struggles are trying to keep up with the most recent threats. There's not a day that goes by that I'm not on a call trying to understand how we're going to mitigate whatever risk has been introduced that particular week. You know, you've got Microsoft coming out with Patch Tuesdays on their own issues. So there isn't ever a scenario where we've got stability and we've got it all figured out and we're implementing. And so what's interesting about this role is, you know, we're constantly having to change and adjust, and that's a difficult thing to do. So when you think about a leader in any organization, you know, stability is usually the core, where you set a defined set of priorities and you execute against those. Try doing that where it's changing every month. And now with new innovations like AI and all the concerns that are now being introduced with AI, you know, that's just complicating it even more.
So Rich, it's interesting because you talked about there's so many different variations in the way that people attack these problems, right? So I remember years back, a couple sales guys came to me and said, Drew, why don't we just look at the regulations for the banks and then we'll know exactly what problems to solve for them, right? It's very simple. You know, you have a regulation, you have a problem, you put in a control. Everybody should do it the same way. So we'll just go with that approach. And what I always saw was the banks that I did business with all attacked the problems in very different ways, right? Some were heavily pen test oriented, some were heavily tool oriented, yet all regulated by the same group of regulators. Well, why do we see that in particular in the financial services market?
Yeah, so I think there's probably a couple of things driving that. One, and probably the most prevalent, is legacy debt. And so if you were to build all of those banks from the ground up using the same framework, I think you could arrive at the same conclusion, the same set of controls. I think the biggest challenge is operationally. So while it seems easy on paper to just implement all the same sets of controls, each bank or each regulated industry is going to be at a different level of maturity as those regulations get introduced. And so it becomes a very personalized or very specialized implementation. And quite frankly, there's differences in personalities. Different leaders think they can solve it differently or will disagree that the approach that leader number one or leader number two took is the right approach. And so you see that variation. Like I said, it's not as scientific or defined as you would say, you know, removing an appendix where, you know, there's an industry accepted way to do that. There's a lot of variation, and you're starting to see an introduction of, frankly, personalities come into the mix in terms of how they think it's best to solve that problem. And not only do the threats change, but the technologies change. So I can tell you even personally, you know, we'll start down a journey of implementing a solution to solve a problem. That solution may get acquired by a larger company. There may be something better that comes down the pike. And so by the time you get through procurement, contracts, deployment, testing, and actually get that thing into production, you're at best case scenario, two years down the pike. And so a lot changes in the cybersecurity realm within 2 years. And so in some cases, and I've seen it personally, you deploy something and then you're starting from scratch because something's better now. And those have been really hard decisions to make, but you sort of have to put, you know, there's that poker concept of pot committed. People feel invested. They've spent the money. They've spent the time. But you have to understand when the right time is to stop and move on to something else. And it happens more often than not, more often than you might think in terms of, you know, trying to get value out of the deployment.
So one follow-up on, you know, sort of the analogy with a surgery, and I'm taking the cynical view on purpose. You don't have to go with me here. You can tell me that that's not a fair question. I could look at surgery as this is the best way to restore the health of the patient. We have this procedure because it's the best way to restore the health of the patient. I can also look at surgery as we do it this way because it's least likely to get us into a lawsuit that we lose. And I can look at security controls in the same way, especially, you know, when I think about regulatory things and other things. And so where do you see an active balancing act between, I'm not going to say it's the right thing to do. We're not talking about ethics here, where this is the best thing to do versus this thing is good enough to get us not sued. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So it's interesting. So I don't know that any security practitioner with a good conscience would look at good enough. And so what I would tell you is this, there's a balance between, you've mentioned regulators several times, and I would say they're one stakeholder in the equation. You've got the board, you've got the regulators, you've got your stakeholders. There's a balance between appeasing all of those entities in terms of investing in the right approach. And so I'll draw another analogy aside from the surgery, and we'll call it an insurance policy. So cybersecurity is very, very much an insurance policy. And so, you know, my peers have all been exposed to board level pitches where, you know, we're constantly asking for more funding, for more investments in the cyberspace. Now, if you put yourself on the other side of that table, and you're on the board or you're on the side where you've got to fund these initiatives, the natural question, absent any knowledge of cybersecurity or foundational knowledge of cybersecurity, would be, tell me how much I need to spend in order to make my bank, my company secure. And there's no answer for that. There is no answer where I can provide you 100% assurance that you won't get breached or you won't be impacted by, you know, the threat that none of us know about until next week. And so it becomes an insurance policy approach where you're trying to find out what the balance is. So how much to spend? Are you investing in the right coverage? Are you investing in the right areas? And again, that's where I think when we, if we double back to the conversation we had a couple minutes ago, you know, why do you see so much variation? So there's no one policy that will, or no one policy approach that gives you the right coverage and the right amounts. You have to figure out what have you already invested in? What do you need to invest in? And that, again, that's got to be balanced against the current approaches. To answer your question in terms of, you know, do you do what's right for the organization or do you do just enough? I think there's an element of that across the different domains. And so you'll see a lot of different companies use a lot of different approaches to try to determine what to invest in next. And so some will use NIST, some will use, you know, other frameworks to try to determine where they have high levels of maturity, low levels of maturity. And that sort of drives your insurance policy discussion on where to invest in next. There's, again, there's no right approach. There's a couple of ways that you can, you know, you've got tools, all of us have tools that are probably underutilized. There's overlapping capabilities. You know, behavior analytics is probably the most prevalent one that we've seen come out in the past couple of years. Do you buy individual products that all have behavioral analytics capabilities, or do you invest in a centralized behavioral analytics capabilities? Again, that goes back to the operational piece. Do you want 20 dashboards to look at, or do you want one dashboard to look at? And so you have to figure out how to integrate. And does that really give you any benefit that a product has a behavioral analytics capability if you've already got that managed centrally? And so it becomes really, really difficult to determine the overlap and determine what you need to invest in next to really start defining answers to those questions on how much is enough and where do you draw the line? There's actually a Consortium Networks is a company that put out this, I think it's actually a free solution called Metrics That Matter. Probably one of the most advanced analytics capabilities in terms of defining solutions. They've got mapped to NIST and other frameworks, and you put all your solutions and capabilities in there. In so much that they've even gone so far as new threats can't come out. You can run what if scenarios through it to try to determine whether or not you've got the right coverage to mitigate that threat. So that's just one example, but that's what we have to do on a week-to-week basis. And there are very few solutions in the marketplace that allow you to do that. So when a threat comes out that impacts third parties, we're still very much as an industry in manual mode. We're calling each other, literally phone calls over a weekend to say, hey, this zero day came out. Are you vulnerable to that? Are you susceptible to that? Because I do business with you. You have my data, and I need to answer to my superiors of whether or not we've got a risk to the organization. And so it becomes very difficult to manage that at scale. So as advanced as we are, as far as we've come from a capability perspective, there are a ton of really, really innovative technology solutions out there, but that's only the tip of the iceberg. That just buying a solution does not in and of itself help you manage the benefits of that, because you still have things like third-party risk. You still have, you know, do you have full coverage? So managing it or deploying a solution, is it on all of your endpoints? Is it working? If it is deployed, is it active on the endpoints? And so there's a lot that goes into answering that question of, you know, do you have enough? I would say most of us have done a decent job, but not enough job of looking really, really deep to make sure that we've got our own house in order before adding something new. So there's always that balance of, you know, how much more do you need to add compared to what you've already deployed, and how effective is that? And so you're starting to see, even from a regulatory expectation perspective, you know, show me your operational metrics. Show me that you've got your agents deployed on all your endpoints. Show me that they're working. Show me that they're talking back to the command and control. Show me. It's coming up more and more and more. And from a regulatory perspective, they're frustrated. So, you know, we as much as we like to hold the regulators as the bad guys, they're really trying to enforce good hygiene and good practices to make sure that, you know, if we were as good as we all thought we were, we wouldn't have major breaches on a weekly basis, right? So I remember listening to the Comptroller of the Currency probably about 6 months ago talk about why there's an increase in regulatory expectations. And quite frankly, you could hear the frustration in his voice. They're dealing with five major breaches a week. And it's not that the answers are unknown. Multi-factor authentication, as an example, guidance has been around for decades. Companies just haven't implemented it. And so they, the regulators, would look at that as a very simple way to offset some of the risks, yet the adoption rates are probably not where they need to be. And so you're starting to see increased pressure on regulated entities to start adopting some of those controls. And, you know, the U.S. is very much different than some of our peer countries. And so you look at Monetary Authority of Singapore, they're very prescriptive. They will tell you how to implement the controls, what controls to implement, and what coverage they expect, where U.S. regulators offer guidance. You know, there's no mandated. There are some instances on things like PCI compliance, you know, that which is not technically a regulated entity, but regulators will offer guidance. There's FFIEC guidance. They call it guidance for a reason. But I wonder and ponder whether or not at some point U.S. is going to start migrating more toward some of the approaches that other regulators have taken in terms of mandating controls versus expecting controls. And we're starting to see that expectation creep up, and the scrutiny around adoption of that guidance is increasing as well.
Rich, you brought up a couple of interesting things: frameworks, maturity, those things. When I look back, you know, 14, 15 years ago when we built BSIM, you know, so many of our customers were begging for some way to measure and guidance around building the core of their AppSec programs, for example, right? What do you see today? I mean, do you see that people have pretty much done that heavy lifting and are really now dialing things in? Or do you still see as an industry that there are a lot of you know, FIs, for example, that are still struggling with kind of how do I get started and really build that core foundation of a program, whatever that may be, to get myself to a certain level of maturity? How do you see people dealing with it?
Yeah, I think that answer varies domain by domain. I think some domains are more clearly defined than others. So AppSec is probably the most, where I see the most variation. So, you know, do you pen test only your high risk? And so I answer that question a different way. Like the one thing that I'll tell you is the measurement of maturity is shifting away from things like NIST maturity and shifting more toward MITRE attack frameworks and threat scenarios. And so if I take the application security example, you know, I can do all the analysis I want to show senior leaders and our board how well our application security program is structured. At the end of the day, an attacker doesn't care how I categorize applications. They don't care if I categorize something as a low-risk application or a high-risk application or what controls are put around it. All they care about is how they're getting in. And so it's really up to us to then, you know, it's what I'm starting to see is a fundamental shift away from industry framework measurements and more toward the real attack scenarios. And so how would an attacker compromise an application and use that advantage to then, you know, potentially laterally move across the network or access data? And if the answer to that is low-risk applications are just as susceptible to that attack as a high-risk application, you can't do it all, but you also can't ignore that threat. You're not mitigating that threat if your internal risk, risk-based approach doesn't align with the threat scenarios, then you're putting yourself at a disadvantage. And so, like, the question you asked is, you know, where do we see the industry? I think we're starting to reevaluate with that new lens of threats versus things like NIST, we're realizing that we may need to take a different approach. And so in some respects, there's a resurgence or a re-kickstart of how we approach things like application security, network security, perimeter security.
Okay. Thank you.
So, Rich, you know, as let's say we've reached some kind of stasis today, some balance point. Maybe we're not happy with it, you know, because, you know, five breaches a week or whatever the number actually is. And, you know, and that's just in the financial community, perhaps, you know, so it might be 5,000 breaches a week. But we have some kind of stasis. The world isn't on fire. You know, we're still can buy stuff from Amazon. I can get my dog food delivered, you know, next day. The world's working. Well, in your opinion, and perhaps maybe not just for banks, but what's the biggest problem, you know, we should solve going forward? Like, if we could put all of our money into one thing, you know, would we solve, I don't know, asteroids, solar radiation? I mean, what's the big thing for cybersecurity? Not my opinion, but I want to hear yours.
Yeah. So assuming you've reached a high level of maturity, I just want to make sure I understand the question. High level of maturity, what do you do next?
As either individually or as an industry, you know, what should the cybersecurity industry solve next to give the biggest bang for the buck to every human with a computer,
yeah,
you know, or every business with a computer?
Yeah, I would say preparing for the future. So if you look at, I don't know that anyone in my peer group would look at their cybersecurity program and say that it's a high level of maturity. So I think that's probably a far-reaching statement to say that we've reached a high level of maturity. That's a utopia that's going to be really hard to accomplish. I think when you look at getting to utopia, it's important to put in, I hate to use the word frameworks because it's always so overused, but more or less a framework that prepares you for the future. And so we're very much, I don't want to say it as a universal statement, but reactive mode is usually the less, you know, the less ideal approach, where we're constantly trying to figure out, well, how do we adjust for this next threat? Or where do we have gaps in our cybersecurity program where we need to add, you know, net new controls? I would say if I reached a high level of cybersecurity maturity, I would be going back through my cybersecurity program to determine where I need to mature that so that I'm future-proofing it, where I've applied some of the band-aids, where maybe I can start looking at platform consolidation or solution consolidation. You know, every platform comes with its own risk. So every vendor that I use, I've got a third-party program to assess the risks associated with that vendor. You know, the regulators will tell you can outsource the function, but not the risk. And so with every relationship, I think Michael Dell had done this early when he had taken over the company. He pulled all of his vendors together in one big room and said, look to your left, look to your right, look behind you and in front of you. Three of you won't be here at the end of this weekend. And he consolidated, you know, a lot of his, I think 20% of his vendors remained. And he, you know, he optimized his, the production of Dell computers using sort of a just-in-time inventory. So there was nothing wrong with the way Dell was producing computers. It just wasn't an efficient way of producing computers. And so cyber is very much the same way. We may be reaching a higher level of maturity as we're adding new capabilities, but if I was at that state, I'd be looking behind me, understanding how do I do platform consolidation to maintain fewer vendor relationships while still maintaining, and also focus on demonstrating operational effectiveness. And so regardless of whether you're a regulated entity or not, you need to know what's working and what's not working. It's always the gotchas. You know, I thought I had my endpoints deployed to, or my agents deployed to all the endpoints, but alas, we forgot this small population in this part of the business.
Yeah, it did.
You may have tactical deployments non-centralized deployments where, you know, you're tolerating it, but it's not optimized. And so, you know, that's the advice I would give someone who declared a high state of cybersecurity maturity.
So, Rich, I still see, like, third party. You bring up third party. It's been a problem that we've had for a long time, right? You and I have talked about it for years. when I look at attacking that problem with my customers, the thing that I find most difficult in it is that it's not owned by any one person in an enterprise. So the CISO owns part of it. The CIO may have to deploy tooling. The risk department definitely owns a big chunk of it because they typically own third-party risk, right? This also may sit in the CFO's organization. I find you have, I don't know, at least three, maybe four stakeholders, senior stakeholders, that own this third-party problem when you look at trying to solve it. And nobody can really make the call about, okay, let's go spend or invest in it. And so I still don't see a lot of people really digging in and really getting down to solving the core problem. They're still, to me, poking around the edges. And so how do you think we get there as an industry when you look at that? Because I think the third-party risk is still a big problem.
Yeah. So third-party. So that's
or supply chain. Call it either one, right?
Our biggest benefit and our biggest liability as well. And so third-party is where you typically see a lot of the innovation. So a lot of these smaller companies are able to innovate because they're not regulated, because they have the flexibility to use some of the, you know, they're not large, they're not the Titanic. And so they can move more nimbly and agile. The challenge is, so and I'll just give you our personal experience. When we're dealing with any third party, we're still subject to the same set of controls against that third party as we would as if we built that capability in-house. So I think I mentioned it earlier, you can outsource the function, but you can't outsource the risk.
Right.
And it's always a challenge for the third parties to try. You think about where the largest investment in cybersecurity, you got government and usually the financial sector. You know, those are so why would I turn my security over to a third party that I know is not going to invest in the same level as I would? And so what we're starting to see is where we have the need for increased controls, so monitoring. You know, go ahead and I'll give you my, I want your software, but I don't want to give you my data, and I certainly don't want you replicating the logging and monitoring investments that I put into place. And so what you're starting to see, and maybe not to the extreme that some of the government agencies have gone through, where they'll build a SCIF and they'll leave the data in the SCIF, and then the third parties will have to figure out how to layer their software on top of it. They never get access to it. You we're not seeing that extreme, but what we are starting to see is consolidations of things like log. So if I'm in Azure and the third party provider that I'm using is in Azure, and we're both using the same native capabilities in Azure, then why not feed me your security logs? Why not allow me to see what's going on in your environment so that I can integrate with what I already have invested so that I don't have to rely on your detective capabilities to identify when there's a problem? And you're starting to see more and more of that, where larger organizations are starting to become, I don't want to say integrated, but have a longer list of dependencies on what they expect from the third party so that you're not outsourcing everything. And so I would rather lead the third party innovation to the third parties and keep as much of the security control as I possibly can. But again, that's all subject to things like contracts and what the third parties will actually allow. But I think with the expanded use of cloud and the synergies that you're seeing across cloud environments, it just makes it a lot easier. So you now have cross-tenant sharing capabilities for things like security logs that allow me to monitor a little bit easier than I might have been able to do a decade ago.
It makes sense. Yeah, more people doing the due diligence, so that's good. More eyes on it.
Yeah. Well, and as everything gets automated, you have, you know, telemetry, tons and tons and tons of telemetry, more than you can ever process. Hopefully AI helps with some of that in a non-intrusive way, but that creates a new attack surface, whether you like it or not. It has hallucinations. It creates its own risks that we have no idea how to control yet, that the regulators are maybe just starting to think about. So yes, I'm all for it. I'd love to see everybody generate more data and share it more. I'm not convinced that the vast majority of organizations can make sound decisions from it. It's just more. It's not better. For me, in my opinion.
Yeah. So, Rich, I mean, well, we talked a little bit about third party. Why don't we shift for a second as we talk about the future? You spent a lot of your career in IAM. So where are we going here with authentication? Is the password dead? Or, you know, what are we going to do to solve this problem? You talked multi-factor a minute ago, which is pretty much the industry standard today. But is there something new on the horizon?
So is the password dead? That's a question. I think we would all like the password to be dead. I don't think there's any one of us that enjoy remembering passwords. I saw a funny meme one time that said somebody stole my password, now I have to rename my dog. And while it's funny, it's true. I mean, people are unfortunately the weakest link when it comes to something you know. So people want to pick easy things to remember. Because remember, you've got customers and users of all ages that want to keep it simple. And so you're starting to see, it's been in motion for a while. NIST revised their guidance to move away from things like periodic password changes. Microsoft stopped changing passwords. The FTC stopped using passwords. And so you're starting to see things like the FIDO2 Alliance starting to gain more traction. And so the common IAM mandate is, you know, pick two things, something you know and something you are. Or something you have, and you know, pick any two of those and you should be good. And what we're starting to see is, you know, a sharp increase in social engineering that, you know, something you know is probably the most, even with something you have, it really translates into something you know. So soft tokens as an example, or hard tokens, really just produce a value that can be phished. And so I tend not to look at the something you have, something you know, something you are, but I look at it from a fishable versus non-fishable lens. You know, can this be harvested? Can this credential be harvested? And if you've got multi-factor authentication with two sets of authenticators that are fishable, then you're exposed. And so what you're starting to see is a larger adoption of things like the FIDO2 Alliance, where, you know, your devices, you need to have physical possession of devices and keys, which cannot be phished. I think Google moved toward that several years ago and has declared, you know, no major security incident from, I think they're a YubiKey user. And while that's an extreme, it's not far-fetched from, I think, directionally where we need to go as an industry. The challenge is, you know, I say passwords are dead, and I say that with a tongue-in-cheek approach, but the biggest mistake that many of us make is we start implementing some of these advanced technologies like FIDO2, and we allow passwords to remain because people forget their device or they lose their device and we have to reset passwords. And so there's a concept of identity proofing and identity assurance. The identity proofing is you are who you say you are. This is Drew Kilborn on the other end of the phone. Identity assurance is the credentials that I gave Drew Kilborn are being used by Drew Kilborn. And what we tend to do is if I forget one of the authenticators, we allow another authenticator to then reset the credentials or let you in versus backing up to the identity proofing, which is, wait a minute, I need to make sure that this is Drew Kilborn resetting an authenticator. And there's a lot of reasons for that. Obviously, you know, employer customer experience and operational impact. But again, you're starting to see that back up to those foundational concepts of if you forgot your authenticator, I need to re-identity proof you. And that's where you see the strongest deployments, where firms are leveraging the identity proofing aspect to reset authenticators versus just using another authenticator. And so the reason I say that is we move toward passwordless solutions, but allow a password to remain so that things like password reset capabilities can still be leveraged, which is, you know, arguably the less secure approach.
Yeah. Yeah. And that all sounds perfectly reasonable when I'm going to, you know, Reddit or maybe even Amazon. But, you know, when I got to log into my pacemaker, I probably can't wait 3 days for my password reset to be based on my you know, my passport being renewed or something. Anyway, sorry, not trying to get in the last word. You know, Rich, to cap off our chat for today, you know, you've been doing this for a long time. What keeps you in it? What keeps you forging ahead on cybersecurity as a path, as a career, as something that stimulates you? Why are you still here?
Yeah, I love the challenge. You know, as we talked about, you know, I wish there was an easy path to get to Utopia. I'm still trying to find that path. But what keeps me interested is the prospect of making the industry better. So I love sharing experiences and helping folks that are maybe new to the field understand some of the pitfalls that maybe I tripped up over and I don't want them to repeat. And honestly, it really starts with foundational things like inventory. We overlook some of the basic aspects of cybersecurity programs, like knowing what your asset bases are and, you know, how do you know your controls are applied? But, you know, the challenge keeps me in it, the ability to share what I've learned and some of the mistakes I've made and hopefully make others better than I am is something that I really look forward to.
Cool. I can tell you that I for one wake up every day looking forward to make entirely new mistakes. I mean, you know, who wants to make the same mistake over and over? So Rich, thank you very much for spending time with us. We're sure your insights have helped someone address a challenge in their organization or in their career path. To our audience, you can find this and other podcasts at https://podcast/synopsis-software-security. You can also leave comments there. We'd love to hear from you. If you'd like to contact us directly, please send an email to thenextdecadepodcast@synopsis.com. Thank you to our listeners. Thank you to Rich Jones. And we hope you'll all join us again next time. Goodbye.